On this week's 51%, a drone photographer endeavors to get more women into the field, while another photographer tells her subjects to lose the smile.
I just want to go into a different mood. I want to bring out a different realm. And I kind of want to make it moody. I like moody.
And a transgender woman makes history in the world of politics. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. According to Beacon Sky's survey, fewer than 4% of remote drone pilot certificates are held by women. The female founder of the aerial mapping and surveying services company analyzed the FAA's 2016 civil airmen statistics and found the highest percentage of female drone pilots at 6% could be found in Montana, New Mexico, Vermont, and Washington, with some 8% in Alaska and Hawaii. Based in Southern California, Emily Kasten is an award-winning photographer and videographer who specializes in landscape, aerial, and portrait work. But it was through her commercial real estate clientele that she fell in love with flying drones, and she works to inspire women to enter the field. Kasten shares her reaction to the figure of 4% of drone pilots are female.
I was shocked myself when I found that out. I knew it was pretty low and that it was really hard for me to find other female drone pilots that are doing what I'm doing, but I honestly had no idea it was that to that extreme.
Why? Why do you think it's this low?
I think, honestly, people often associate boys with the toys and gadgets, and it's a limiting connection since females love their gadgets as well. It's a new industry that kind of mirrors the tech world that's led mostly by men, and there aren't many advertisements depicting women flying drones. So, naturally, that's what the younger generation picks up on, and they fail to educate themselves to learn more about drone usage. So in a sense, I just want to change the stigma and this assumption that guys have to be playing, you know, with these drones and toys. And that's why I love helping others as they develop their craft. And I'm trying to educate females to get out there and give droning a chance.
Right. We hear over and over again how important it is to see people who look like you in careers, in leadership roles, etc. So what are you doing on your end to help women gain access to becoming federally licensed commercial drone pilots?
What I'm doing is I'm actually offering one-on-one mentoring sessions where I provide tips, whether it's through Skype or in person. I can teach them how to fly and use their drone. I just find that it's very helpful. While some people just sell presets and tell people what to do, I find I like to be there and be very hands-on and help people. And so I've been just pushing it out there and trying to find girls that are doing or are interested in doing the same thing that I'm doing.
And what about reaching out to girls specifically?
I mean, the one thing that's been very useful is Instagram, because the younger generation constantly uses it. So I'm on there trying to find girls that are doing what I'm doing. I'm curating a list of girls in order to send out a newsletter and send out information to kind of just focus on what it's like to be a female in this kind of industry and how we can help each other, and just make it like a monthly thing where I kind of give them advice and tips and kind of help them as they grow their own business.
You know, it's interesting because you talk about this tech gadget being marketed to men, and yet one doesn't need to have technical expertise to operate it.
I mean, you don't need to be technical to be doing what I'm doing. You don't need a degree anymore. There are endless opportunities out there, and they don't require you to have a degree, let alone to be someone who's an engineer. So if you look at me, I took my drone and I applied my artistic talent. To me, it's an art form, and it's not just a machine. It allows me to be artistic from this bird's eye view. That would be almost like saying you need to be technical to drive a car. I mean, you learn how to drive and then use it as a method of transportation to go about your day. I learned how to drive my drone or fly my drone, and now I use it to create this artistic look to my feed.
So, Emily, how did you become a drone photographer, and were there obstacles?
Absolutely. I mean, I grew up in the heart of Orange County, about 20 minutes inland from the beach, and I kind of grew up around cameras, so that part was kind of easy. My dad always kind of had a camera attached to his hand, and I always loved, was obsessed with visual storytelling. But, I mean, I kind of tried a few different things before the right passion stuck, And I went to Brooks Institute of Photography School up in Santa Barbara and pursued a photography career and started my own portrait business and was very passionate about it, but realized that something was missing. And there's something about being out in nature that just kind of eased me. And, like, I just felt at peace. It's where I can meditate, where I feel, like, the most in touch with myself and with everything around me. And my brother-in-law works in commercial real estate, and he could tell I was in a funk, and he suggested that I purchase a drone just to test it out and see what it's like to do commercial real estate. So I started using that, and getting good at it took a lot of practice, but I kind of just enjoyed the process of just going out wearing a hard hat on a construction site and flying. It was just so enjoyable. It felt like a video game, but you have to be smart about it, not do anything stupid. But for me, I just enjoyed the whole process, and there was a lot of challenges out there. I mean, there was definitely a couple of hard hitters. When I first started droning a few years ago, there weren't many female drone pilots to look up to. I was walking into these, you know, construction sites, and it was hard to be taken seriously in the male-dominated industries. I was fearful of what it would mean to ease out of my portrait business and into an entirely new field of photography. Also, the commercial real estate industry is a saturated market. There's a ton of droners out there, and I had to learn how would I overcome that. So I discovered a way to stand out with my unique colorized images, and I began sharing these tips on how to capture these images like mine. I opted to help others as they develop their droning skills and with these mentoring sessions, and I've started taking jobs shooting hotels and products for brands, and sometimes they will sponsor me to include them in these social media posts, but I only kind of reserve this for brands I authentically love and support.
Wait, when you talk about the colorized images, are you talking about real estate or nature?
When I branched out to my own, honestly, when I started photos out in nature and started just doing that on the side for fun, I started gaining attention that I didn't expect.
But you were in the commercial real estate photography field.
I still work in it. I definitely find my passion is in the creative side, and that's why I started picking up these hotel jobs and working with products for brands, because I can kind of apply my own creative kick to it.
That was Emily Kasten, a drone photographer in California. When parents hire Shelley Mossman to photograph their children, they're encouraged to bring an animal to the studio and leave the smiles behind. KFAI's Nancy Rosenbaum produced this audio portrait of an unconventional photographer for hire.
In a photo studio in Northeast Minneapolis, I'm Nancy Rosenbaum.
Okay, just getting a light thing here. Oh, yeah.
Shelley Mossman is an award-winning photographer who creates otherworldly portraits of children, often with animals. And one of the many unusual things about her photos is that she tells children not to smile.
No smiling, kind of serious. Smiling is not going to work with my stuff. I want it to be a little bit, I wouldn't say serious, but unpredictable. Oh, the guys, this is great. He's a natural, your cat.
Mossman has this ongoing project she calls the Animal Child Series. The first time I ever saw one of these photos, it was a picture of a group of kids in a living room with a live horse. I wasn't sure it was real. Mossman's photos look like 19th century oil paintings, or illustrations from a leather-bound fairy tale book. The unsmiling children in Mossman's world seem powerful, even a little menacing.
I just want to go into a different mood. I want to bring out a different realm. And I kind of want to make it moody. I like moody.
Mossman likes dressing kids in elegant costumes. They sometimes even wear crowns.
And this is my storage and dressing room.
She keeps racks of vintage clothing in her studio, so she can mix and match outfits from different eras to create a timeless image.
I loved that it looked almost dangerous.
When Patty Hall first saw one of Mossman's photos, it kind of took her breath away.
I don't know, it looked like a different perspective on how we capture youth.
Patty is a mom and a theater artist. She's brought her 14-year-old son Will to Mossman's studio, along with their pet cat.
You know, he's super easy to handle. He just kind of does whatever. He's a really chill cat. He's great.
Will is about 6'2", with sandy-colored hair that flops in his eyes. Mossman's dressed him up in a cherry red marching band jacket. It looks like it's from the late 1800s. Underneath, he wears an Atari t-shirt. It's a wink to his love of video games, but with a vintage twist.
So what I'm going to have you do is kind of sit up a little straight.
Will sits in front of a tapestry. It's of an autumn forest scene with orange and rust-colored leaves.
Remember pinkies? And then sit up slowly. Let's just see what happens. Keep going, keep going, keep going.
Will's cat climbs on his back and shoulders.
And kitty, kitty! I mean, we got that.
If you look at the arc of Mossman's career, these animal child portraits are relatively new. After graduating from the Minneapolis College of Art and Design in the mid-1990s, she spent nearly two decades shooting weddings. Lots of weddings, over 500 of them. And she loved it.
I thought it was almost unnatural to have such a fun job and make that kind of money. But I enjoyed it for a very long time.
But then about 10 years ago, things changed. There was the recession. There was the shift from film to digital photography. Mossman had to figure out how to reboot her business. One day, back in 2013, she spontaneously took a picture of a friend's daughter and her Pomeranian. And that's how the Animal Child series got started. Now she's shot over 80 of these portraits. As a wedding photographer, Mossman would parachute into other people's lives to capture a specific moment, something they'd carefully curated. But now she gets to be the curator. People pay her to be characters in the stories and world she wants to make. Will's mom, Patty, was happy to let Mossman work her magic. Today's photo session is a way for Patty to freeze a moment in Will's life before it passes her by.
I think he's got like 5 minutes left of his childhood. And I love the idea that that's going to be the portrait that we have of him, is the last moment before he's a man. And how close do you think that is to the truth? How close do you feel to being a man?
I don't know. I've never been a man before, so I can't really judge.
I suppose.
As much as Mossman's work is constructed in a studio with outfits and styling, there's a spontaneous wildness to her photos. It comes from her signature combination of animals, children, and a storybook backdrop.
I think everything needs to remain spontaneous. Yeah, a lot of the images that I've created, I couldn't have planned myself. I just put myself into the predicament, and then certain things just reveal themselves. And I'm actually still confused about it. I'm just happy people like it. This is great. I think he's getting into it.
For KFAI, I'm Nancy Rosenbaum.
Kitty is having something to say over there.
Look at this photograph. Every time I do, it makes me laugh. How did our eyes get so red? And what the hell is on Joey's head? This is where I grew up. I think the
voters in Vermont in August chose their general election candidates and made history in the Democratic gubernatorial primary. Christine Hallquist is now the first openly transgender person to win a major party's nomination for governor in U.S. history. 51%'s Pat Bradley has more.
Four balloted and one write-in candidate ran in Vermont's Democratic gubernatorial primary. Unofficial results from the Vermont Secretary of State's office show that Christine Hallquist won the Democratic primary with 40% of the vote. James Ellers and Brenda Siegel are virtually tied with 18% each. Nearly 7% of Vermont Democrats voted for 14-year-old Ethan Sonneborn. The write-ins have not been delineated, but State Senator John Rogers mounted a late campaign. 5% of Democrats wrote in their vote. Hallquist is receiving national attention as the first transgender woman to win a major party nomination for governor. She only briefly acknowledged that in her victory speech. She says she has great faith in Vermont, and her campaign message resonated across the state.
My message was about, you know, putting more food on the table. You know, our current governor keeps talking about no new taxes. Of course, nobody wants new taxes, neither do I. But a good leader has a long-term plan how we're going to grow, our economy. And rural, you know, rural Vermont, two-thirds of the Vermont residents are rural. You know, rural Vermont's suffering, and we got to have a plan for how to make things better for those people who live in rural Vermont, as well as those that are living on the lowest 20% or the lowest part of the economic ladder.
Middlebury College Professor Emeritus of Political Science, Eric Davis.
Christine Alford had a bit more money than the other candidates. In the last 2 weeks in particular, I think she spent a lot of time traveling around the state, getting her message out. She did not get half the vote in the primary. She got about 40%. And two of the other candidates who got roughly 18 to 20% each, or in total about the same as Christine Hallquist, ran as more explicitly progressive candidates. So Christine Hallquist's challenge, I think, is getting the progressive Democrats in the base to get enthusiastic about her if they might not have been enthusiastic about her before the primary.
In Vermont's Republican gubernatorial primary, first-term incumbent Phil Scott defeated Keith Stern, a businessman with no political experience, 65 to 31%. During his victory speech, Scott commended his challenger for running and proceeded to outline his accomplishments during his first term. He added that he wants to accomplish more.
Looking ahead, as I've consistently done throughout my political life, I will run a positive, issues-based campaign over the next 3 months, talking to Vermonters about the things that matter most to them and working every day to grow the economy, make Vermont more affordable, and protect the vulnerable.
Scott said he had expected the primary result to be closer. Davis says while Scott won by roughly a 2-to-1 margin, he could be vulnerable with a core contingent of voters.
There is a core group of conservatives in the Republican Party, in the base, who feel strongly about the Second Amendment, about supporting President Trump, about very conservative fiscal policy, and they're not particularly enthusiastic about Phil Scott. So just as Christine Alford's challenge for the general election is motivating the progressives in the Democratic base, support her, so Phil Scott's challenge in the general election is going to be motivating the conservatives in the Republican base to support him.
For her part, Hallquist says in Vermont, there has been very little emphasis on her gender despite headlines.
Vermonters aren't considering the fact that I'm transgender anything unusual. They're looking through to say, what are we going to do for Vermont? Of course, on the national level and the international level, it's significant, and I respect both of those. You know, I'm honored to be a leader and helping the country widen its moral compass and be more accepting of others.
Roughly twice as many votes were cast in the Democratic than in the Republican primary. Audio from Governor Phil Scott is courtesy of Vermont Public Radio. For 51%, I'm Pat Bradley.
Tunisia's president has promised to submit a bill to parliament that aims to give women equal inheritance rights with men, as debate over the topic of inheritance reverberated around the Muslim world. In a speech marking Women's Day in Tunisia, President Beji Caid Essebsi said he wants to submit the proposal as soon as possible, probably when parliament resumes in October. The current system, which is based on Islamic Sharia law, generally grants daughters only half the inheritance given to sons, and is standard practice in most Muslim countries. Many Muslim clerics see the inheritance rules as enshrined in the Quran, Islam's holy book. Since independence from France in 1956, Tunisia has been a standard bearer in the Muslim world for women's rights. In July, a woman from Tunisia's moderate Islamic party was elected mayor of Tunis, the capital, the first time a woman has held the post. The president's decision is based on the recommendations of a 300-page government report. It recommended the change in inheritance rights as well as proposals to end the death penalty and legalize homosexuality, which now in Tunisia is outlawed and punished with 3 years in prison. This next piece is entitled Hecho a Mano y Corazón, or Handmade and Made from the Heart. It's about two sisters continuing a tradition in Texas carried from Mexico.
Marta was only 6 or 7 years old when she made her first embroidered piece of handwork.
Feo, feo, muy feo.
And according to Marta, it was quite ugly. It was a child's version of beauty, with all the colors combined and stitched together. But her mother loved it. It was a gift for Mother's Day. Her sister Oli's, on the other hand,
bonito.
Her school displayed hand-embroidered napkins at the end of the school year. It was a challenge, and the bigger they were, the more beautiful they had to be.
Lo diferente de mi hermana fue feo, lo mío era bonito.
Oli said her first piece turned out much better than Marta's.
Mi nombre es Marta Limones, soy de Ciudad de Durango, México.
Mi nombre es María Olivia Limones y soy de Durango, México.
Marta and María Olivia, better known as Oli, are sisters. They immigrated to Austin, Texas in 1993. Originally from Durango, Mexico, they grew up on a ranch, abundant with farm animals, chores, and above all, family. Oli welcomed us into her apartment. Her home is full of photographs of family members. Each frame is placed on a handmade crocheted doily. The sisters recall learning to crochet with their mother in Mexico.
From a very young age, we watched our mother. She liked crochet and embroidery. Then she began to teach us embroidery, sewing, and crochet. She taught us to do a lot of housework and crafts. There was a lot of work to do on the ranch. And aside from our chores, it was a way for us to contribute to the household. Our mother always wanted us to be kept busy through sewing and helping at home. She would teach us in the afternoons and in the evenings after we had finished our chores. Sometimes the design was painted, and we just had to embroider over the image. Other times we crocheted, and our mother showed us how.
For Marta and Oli, crochet is family. Each crochet piece was created for a family member. As they display their work, family photographs are often proudly shown. Birthdays, Easter, Christmas, christenings. Family celebrations and holidays have all been marked by some example of Marta's or Oli's needle artistry.
I don't make them anymore to sell. I just make them to give them away. I feel more comfortable giving them to people who are interested and appreciate the work I make with my hands. I look at people who like my things so much. I make my crochet, my embroidery, and I feel happy. And I give it to them with pleasure.
Yo hago para mis nietos, cobijas, vestidos para mis nietos, porque a mi nieta le encantan los vestidos.
I make them for my grandchildren, blankets and dresses for my grandchildren, because my granddaughter loves the dresses. She wants all the colors, and I've made several for her. Also, I made them out of necessity. I sold many towels in Mexico because it was difficult there. I couldn't work because I had three small children, so I would crochet at home and then sell them. But now I make them to have as a memory of what I know how to do.
Looking at the explosion of color and fine stitching that covers the table, a gallery in a museum comes to mind. We wonder if Marta or Oli think of themselves as artists.
Well, no, I don't really think of it like that. I thought that nobody was interested in this kind of work, but I see that people do appreciate it. If someone was interested, I would gladly teach them what I know how to do. We make beautiful clothes for baptisms, white outfits. The children get very excited when I make clothes. Our friends also love our work.
And as we visit, we admire the sisters' elaborate and beautiful works. The memory of their mother is always at hand.
Oh, look. This was the last thing my mom sewed. It's a type of embroidery. The pattern is stamped on, and then the embroidery goes over it. The piece is painted, too, and the embroidery goes over the paint. And you continue with a different pattern.
It's very sad for me because it's only been 3 years since she passed away, and the memory is still very fresh.
Just as they watched their mother to learn crochet, their younger family members are learning from them.
I have two nieces who are 38 and 28 or 29. They're really interested in learning, and I'm teaching them what I know, how to crochet and embroider. And they're trying to learn by watching me and seeing what I do. If they're really interested in knowing the tradition, hopefully they will learn and keep them going.
Marta and Oli hope that passing down their mother's art will be one of the threads that tie their descendants close to their Mexican heritage. This story was produced by Jennifer Richter and Allison Bennett Dyke, with assistance from Carlos Salazar, for Stories from Deep in the Heart, a project of Texas Folklife.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1518,